People tend to stare at Kevin Michael Connelly. He's cute, fit, funny, and a champion skier, but he knows that the stares are usually inspired by something else. Kevin Michael Connelly was born without legs. It's not just that he didn't let his legless state prevent him from doing anything. As he writes in his memoir, Double Take, being born without legs drove Kevin Michael Connelly to become a raging competitor at sports and life. Double Take is a memoir built around some of the photos that Kevin Michael Connelly has taken around the world of people staring at him. He calls these shots returning fire with a lens. Double Take has just been published in paperback. Kevin Michael Connelly joins us from the studios of Peak Recording and Sound in Bozeman, Montana. Mr. Connelly, thanks for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And that phrase, returning fire with a lens, what's that mean?
All the way back when I first began taking photos, I think it started in Vienna, Austria. It was kind of this, especially after leaving Montana, this difficult point where I was more or less having to confront the reactions that I was being put in front of. And I think that the first photo, the first snapshot, kind of came from a more or less cathartic or combative stance, in that, you know, if people were going to stare at me, and in some cases, I think even in the book I mention a group of teens taking a cell phone picture of me, you know, I thought that at that point, you know, I had more of a right to turn it into an exchange, to fire back with the lens.
To get this out of the way, you were born with what I get is called bilateral amelia?
Yeah, which more I don't think really means all that much. I was always told, I actually had to look up the official definition when it came down to writing the book, because I'd always been told it was a sporadic birth defect or just born without legs. I mean, there was no other medical complications or anything else. It was just that femurs didn't grow into my hip sockets.
Can I get you to talk about the butt boot?
Yeah. Originally, it was a pair of deerskin pants. Basically, we had this problem where since I was running on my hands, my parents would be saving all this money on shoes, but I'd burn out, you know, a half dozen pairs of pants in a weekend. And, you know, it got worse when it was, you know, 2 feet of snow outside, or just general Montana weather. So yeah, we started working on this thing called the butt boot originally. I mean, we didn't really have a name for it. I think we called it leathers originally. And yeah, it was just a pair of pants held up by a couple bright red suspenders that, you know, would protect you a bit when you were running around. And as I got older and was able to kind of articulate my needs a little bit better, we actually started adding in plastic inserts and gave it a sole. And, you know, it actually has a Birkenstock tread on it now. So we've even gotten a little style added into this device.
We should explain, you commonly do get around on a skateboard, not a wheelchair.
Yeah. I grew up running around on my hands, evolved into this butt shoe. Now my main mode of transport is riding around on a skateboard, or more specifically, like a flexible longboard. And, you know, there's a couple advantages to that. I do use a wheelchair sometimes for like shopping and cooking. For traveling and generally going about town, I found that a skateboard is by far the most practical choice, for a couple of reasons. It's really fast and phenomenally fun. Being the first, I mean, I've gotten to skateboard the Louvre and the Great Wall of China within a 12-month period, which I don't know if many people can say.
Yeah.
You know, but all of the parts to it are replaceable. It's more compact. And those are both clear advantages it has over, you know, the wheelchair, which was up till then my alternative mode of transport.
Sarajevo sounds like the toughest stop on your tour. Fact, for the only time in the book, I believe you talk about giving up this venture.
You know, Sarajevo, there's so much there because it was definitely the hardest for me. Throughout this project and the couple of years where I'd been traveling around and documenting all these photographed stairs, I'd also been getting another reaction from people, which when I'd set down the camera, people would sometimes give me money. Some people would bless me, which happened in Ukraine on a couple of occasions. But the most common, especially in countries where there wasn't as much of a language barrier, would be, you know, what happened to you? And oftentimes that would be in kind of a loaded context. Like, you know, I had one kid in New Zealand ask his mom very loudly at the checkout counter if I'd been eaten by a shark. Even in my hometown of Helena, I had one guy in a pub ask me if I still wore my dog tags from Iraq. When I was in Sarajevo, the experiences were much, much more visceral in terms of what people thought had happened to me. You know, I was seeing people missing arms, occasionally missing a leg, you know, from the Balkan conflicts in the early 90s. And I was just at the right age where it'd be very easy to assume that I was, you know, a little kid running where I shouldn't have been. And so, you know, I had, on top of people coming up and giving me money, sometimes handing me food, you know, I had people actually, you know, apologizing to me or assuming that I was part of this. And I remember distinctly, actually, we were down in the Turkish quarter in Sarajevo, and I saw this guy. He was missing, I think it was his left arm and his right leg. And I sat there eyeballing him and really thinking, you know, what happened to this guy? Why did he find himself in this position? And realized that I was doing exactly the same thing that so many other people had been doing to me, both in this city and around the world. And it really struck home, just because especially there, I felt like regardless of my choosing to do so, I was bringing up maybe a lot of bad memories or bad stories for people around the city, history that they maybe didn't want to constantly be inundated with. And I think that was the most difficult thing, was realizing that regardless of my own choice and my own history, I was in some ways causing pain to certain people in Sarajevo.
I want to get you to talk about your father, who just sounds remarkable. And if that TV series MacGyver has done nothing else, it inspired your father. as far as his son was concerned, yeah.
Honestly, that's one of my favorite chapters in the book. I still remember those memories of watching the show so clearly. You know, him sitting down with, you know, a can of beer and you know, making sure that anytime MacGyver was building something, or the climax of the TV show was going on, he'd always, you know, Kevin. You know, it showed kind of a low-tech ethos of adaptation that, especially in Montana, is really important. I mean, you know, my mom has a line, you know, there's some genius in there, but it's buried real deep. You know, he was this guy that it was clear, I mean, would do anything for us kids, you know, and really, really from the depths of his heart loved, you know, my two sisters and I, still loves. But he goes about that in really unorthodox ways. You know, a guy with a big, it looks kind of like Sam Elliott did. A big, big mustache and long kind of gray hair. And my mom actually said that in reference to him growing his hair and mustache purposefully long to try and offset some of the stares that I was getting. He was, I think his train of logic was, you know, well, if I figure I look a little weirder than him, maybe they'll stare at me a bit more instead. Yeah. You know, I think that was kind of interesting because it showed, you know, how he really didn't care what people thought of him, but, you know, he was willing to do anything necessary to make his kids more comfortable. I have to note, though, you know, there's no way he could have done it alone. And my mom was this really, really solid counterpart. My mom is just this, you know, utter saint and sweetheart and totally bevels off the edges that you know, he inflicts on any situation. So, you know, I think it was definitely a two-person affair.
Kevin Michael Connelly, his memoir, Double Take, just published in paperback. Kevin, so nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well, Scott.
Karan Mahajan is the author of the novel Family Planning. Mahajan was born in the United States, but he grew up in New Delhi. That's also where his first novel takes place. Family Planning is a tragic comic story of a New Delhi politician who's become obsessed with having more and more children, even as his family and city collapses around him. In his own reading, Mahajan admits to enjoying the musings of a grunge rock star who is mostly worshipped by teenagers. Here's his essay for our series, My Guilty Pleasure, in which authors talk about a book they are embarrassed to love.
When you're done reading every last thing by a famous writer, literary convention holds that you move on to his or her letters, the DVD extras peddled by publishers. I have friends who have read the letters of Philip Larkin, Sylvia Plath, Allen Ginsberg, John Cheever, you name it, I have very pretentious friends. So it always embarrasses me to admit that the only complete set of journals I own are those by Kurt Cobain. a rock star. Not just any old rock star, but one who used to cross-dress and rhymes the word mosquito with libido in his most famous song. But for the naysayers who think that the journals have little worth beyond being a pacifier for weepy fans who've been mourning Cobain since he killed himself at the age of 27, I'd like to say, you clearly don't know Cobain the writer. Cobain the writer is funny and self-aware and snotty with a knack for off-the-cuff profundity. Remarking to a friend that his band will be called Nirvana, he scribbles next to it the gleeful words, "Ooh, eerie mystical doom." He also jokingly refers to himself as the moody bohemian member of the group, which is pretty much how most folks remember the man behind that amazing ulcerous voice. Better still, there's a trashy throwaway quality to the pages that makes them a lighter read than you'd expect, like you've accidentally Googled your way onto someone's blog. Page after page of Cobain's terrible handwriting is reproduced in faithful facsimile, covering such topics as forthcoming gigs, favorite songs, prophecies of fame, janitorial wages, and of course, the firing of terrible drummers, complete with gory sketches to drive home his point. What isn't present here, for better or for worse, are hyper-confessional entries that can be used to further dissect why Cobain took his own life. Even in ranting about drug abuse and the pressures of stardom, he comes across as a smirky young man who appreciates his luck and can see the comedy of having turned into a national icon. Novelists get to say plenty in their massive tomes. Rock singers? They only get 4-minute songs with 2 verses and a chorus worth of lyrics. And so there's a real pleasure in accessing the intelligence behind the music, even if it doesn't qualify as great literature. And hey, I'm not the only one who thinks that the journals are better than mere DVD extras. Just ask the poor publisher who had to pony up $4 million for a bunch of chicken scrawl.
Karan Mahajan is the author of the novel Family Planning. His pick for our book series, My Guilty Pleasure, where authors recommend a book they're embarrassed to love, is The Journals of Kurt Cobain. For more summer book stories, interviews, reviews, and commentary, or to comment on this essay, go to npr.org. In a new biography of the best-selling writer and Nobel laureate Pearl S. Buck, the author, Hilary Sperling, quotes a recent New York Times article on Buck that says, quote, "In China, Buck is admired but not read, and in America, she's read but not admired," unquote. Sperling is out to change that estimation of Buck. Here's book critic Maureen Carrigan's review of Pearl Buck in China.
Ever since her 1931 blockbuster, The Good Earth, earned her a Pulitzer Prize and eventually the first Nobel Prize for Literature ever awarded to an American woman, Pearl S. Buck's reputation has made a strange, slow migration. These days, it's her life story rather than her novels, which are now barely read either in the West or in China, that's come to fascinate readers. The big shift was set in motion almost 15 years ago when literary scholar Peter Kahn lifted Buck out of mid-cult obscurity in his monumental biography called simply Pearl S. Buck, A Cultural Biography. Now, award-winning biographer Hilary Sperling has made a case for a reappraisal of Buck's fiction as well as her life. Sperling claims that Buck had a magic power, possessed by all truly phenomenal best-selling authors, to tap directly into currents of memory and dream secreted deep within the popular imagination. Sperling's book is called Pearl Buck in China, and after reading it, I've been motivated to dust off my junior high copy of The Good Earth and move it to the top of my must-read-again-someday pile. Following Kahn's lead, Sperling further succeeds in making Buck herself a compelling figure, transforming her from dreary lady author into woman warrior. Sperling's biography focuses almost exclusively on Buck's Chinese childhood as the daughter of zealous Christian missionaries and young adulthood as the unhappy wife of an agricultural reformer based in an outlying area around Shanghai. Buck was born Pearl Comfort Seidenstricker in 1892, and from her earliest days was much more than a cultural tourist. She roamed freely around the Chinese countryside, where she would often come upon the remains of abandoned baby girls left for the village dogs, and she would bury them. Buck's first language was everyday Chinese, and she grew up listening to village gossip and reading Chinese popular novels like The Dream of the Red Chamber, which were considered sensational by intellectuals, as her own later novels would be. Buck's father, Absalom, was often away, traveling over his mission field, an area as big as Texas, preaching blood and thunder sermons to often hostile Chinese passersby. After the first 10 years he had spent in China, Sperling tells us, Absalom had made, by his own reckoning, 10 converts. The young Buck and her family lived at subsistence level in houses that were little more than shacks, and apartments on streets thronged with bars and bordellos. They managed to survive the Boxer Rebellion and the subsequent violence that heralded the advance of the Chinese nationalists. By the time she arrived as a charity student at Randolph-Macon Women's College in Virginia, Buck was indelibly alienated from her American counterparts. "Girls came in groups to stare at me," wrote Buck, remembering her first harsh college days some 50 years later. She was set apart not only by her out-of-date clothes made by a Chinese tailor, but by her extraordinary life experiences, which encompassed firsthand knowledge of war, infanticide, and sexual slavery. As Sperling deftly illustrates, that alienation gave Buck her stance as a writer, gracing her with the outsider vision needed to interpret one world to another. Buck's unconventional childhood also seems to have made her resistant to groupthink. In midlife, as a famous novelist, she made enemies criticizing the racism of the mission movement. She also shocked contemporaries by writing in her memoir, The Child Who Never Grew, about her brain-damaged daughter, Carol, at a time when such children were quietly institutionalized and publicly forgotten. Sperling quotes liberally from some of Buck's forgotten domestic novels, which defied the mores of her time by depicting sexual despair and revulsion within marriage. And finally, she earned herself no points with China's new leaders when she likened the zealotry of communism to that of her father and his missionary colleagues. Writing in 1954 about an encounter with a breathless Chinese communist woman, Buck said, "And in her words, too, I caught the old stink of condescension." Pearl Buck in China similarly rescues Buck and some of her best books from the stink of literary condescension and replaces that knee-jerk critical response with curiosity.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Pearl Buck in China, Journey to the Good Earth by Hilary Sperling.